Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a talk by Moshe Gershovich, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and director of the Natan and Hannah Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at UNO. The topic of his presentation will be Israel and Palestine, Making Sense of a Never-Ending Conflict. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, September 24, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College.
Tonight, we will be honored to hear Dr. Moshe Gershovich, Professor of History from the University of Nebraska at Omaha, Professor of History and Director of the Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies from the University of Nebraska at Omaha. His topic is Israel and Palestine, Making Sense of a Never-Ending Conflict. When we were finalizing our plans for the Diversity Matters lecture series this summer, we believed that this topic would be one of great importance due to all of the conflict that has continued and concerns us every time we look at our news. So in conversation with many of you are here with instructor Regina Mendenhall, we talked about this is the opportunity to learn perhaps the real story with less of the drama that we see on TV. And with no further ado, welcome.
Thank you very much, Barbara, and good evening, everyone. And for those of us who are, like me, of Jewish origin, Shana Tova, this evening is the beginning of the Jewish New Year, and may we all hope that it will be a better year than the year that just ended, both in general and in particular for that troubled part of the world from which I happen to come, which is Israel. What Barbara didn't mention is that in addition to being a student of the history of the Middle East and particularly of Israel and Palestine, I happen also to be a native-born Israeli. Spent the first part of my life in Israel before coming to this country. By the way, can you all hear me? Yeah? I will try to get as close as possible to the mic. I also hope that you all got the outlines, and if you got a little bit scared by everything that is on it, and there is a lot, I will try to be as brief as possible and get through the history as concisely as possible and still making good sense of it. A man comes to the dentist. He has a problem, a toothache. And the dentist examines him and says, yeah, I need to extract it. How much will it cost me? $500. What? For something that takes 2 seconds, you're going to charge me $500? You know what? You have a point. I'm going to do it in half an hour. In a sense, the bad tooth is the problem between the Israelis and Palestinians. It's been there for a long time, and it's very painful, and it's not going anywhere. The price to be paid, or the solution, is also pretty much known to everyone as well, and it's been set a while ago. But somehow, they don't get it done. They just keep dragging it, and who knows how long it's going to take and how much more suffering there is going to be to both sides, perhaps to one more than the other, but both of them are suffering, and we still don't have an end in sight, even though seemingly the solution is there and the price to be paid is pretty much set. Let me start with a moment in history. 14 years ago, the summer of 2000, when many people, your humble servant included, believed that the end was in sight, that the conflict was about to be over. It wasn't the first time that people tend to believe that. but probably, sadly, the last time that we felt that we were so close to get to it. What actually happened that summer, specifically in July of that year? This is the towards the end of the presidency of Bill Clinton, and I think some of us still remember that period, perhaps not the younger people in the back. And Clinton was fairly determined to salvage part of the legacy of his presidency by achieving what wasn't achieved by anyone before him, bring an end to the Arab-Israeli conflict. Sharing in this belief that this was achievable and needed was the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who came to the U.S. equipped with a plan which he was sure one of those offers you can't refuse. And indeed, what he was putting on the table was as far as any Israeli politician had done before him or since then. Joining them also was the president of the Palestinian Authority at the time, Yasser Arafat, a veteran of the Palestinian struggle for independence, who for a number of years was serving as the president of the authority, essentially the Palestinian government in the making. And they were meeting in a very impressive place, Camp David in Maryland, the place where 22 years earlier, in the summer of 1978, another conference between an Israeli leader and an Arab leader, as well as an American president, in this case Jimmy Carter, produced a historical peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. And the idea, at least, of Barak and Clinton was to reproduce the miracle and create the deal that the peace deal that would bring an end to the entire conflict. Essentially, without getting too much into the details of what was proposed, Barak suggested that Israel would withdraw from the entire Gaza Strip, as well as 95% of the West Bank, on which areas a Palestinian state would be created, dismantling the settlements in those areas that would be evacuated, shared sovereignty of some sort or another in Jerusalem, and addressing also a few other issues, such as resources and, to a lesser extent, the Palestinian refugee problem. Again, no former Israeli politician had gone that far, and in essence, Barak was gambling on his very slim majority government that Arafat would accept the deal and that they would be able to proceed. A gamble that eventually he lost, because even while the conference was happening and details began to emerge, that coalition began to dissolve, and a few weeks later, Barak would be forced to call new elections, which he would lose soundly, and never return to be prime minister. So that was a gamble that both Barak and Clinton did not actually see much positive come from. And the big question was, why did Arafat reject the deal that he was not supposed to reject? All sorts of answers have been given to this, from people who blame Arafat for essentially being dishonest from the beginning and not intending to get to do peace, or getting cold feet at the last moment, especially because he didn't get enough support from his own people, as well as other Arabs. And on the other hand, you have people who say that it was all the arrogance of Barak, who believed that he can pretty much dictate what the treaty would be like, or that it was a misunderstanding about the nature of negotiation between the Western approach that basically goes to the bottom line. Here it is, I already decided what's best for both of us, just let's sign and get to do it. On the other side, the Middle Eastern approach, which says, well, this may be an interesting offer, now let's try to tweak it a little bit. So all sorts of arguments, what exactly happened. One thing is fairly clear. Once it became a failure, again, to the surprise of so many, there was really no way back to restore good faith in negotiation. A few weeks later, another event happens, which is the visit by opposition leader and very controversial right-wing Israeli politician, Ariel Sharon, who a few months later would become prime minister. But as opposition leader, he visits one of the most controversial pieces of real estate in all of history, the Temple Mount, which is, of course, sacred both to Muslims and to Jews. And in this visit, basically provoking intentionally reaction from the Palestinians, the next day the violence begins. And it's important here to understand that Sharon's visit was the trigger to the violence. It was not the cause of it. We now know quite clearly that Arafat was planning on starting the violence again. That summer, he was waiting for the opportunity to do so. Sharon provided the opportunity. And, of course, once the violence starts, the almost predictable pattern that we'll see a bit later start to emerge. We have violence on the Palestinian side, a strong, forceful Israeli response that causes more casualties, which raises the level of violence from the Palestinian side, and so on and so forth. And one of the events that became very symbolic of those early days of the Intifada, the uprising in the summer of 2000, the death of this father and son who are trying to find shelter while Israelis and Palestinians are shooting at each other at the outskirts of Gaza. The child, Mohammed Adoura, got killed. It's still controversial if it was from an Israeli bullet or from a Palestinian bullet. The two sides are still getting at each other on this, but he became a symbol. Within a matter of days, the picture was printed and published all over the Arab world, including where I happened to be at that time in Morocco, very far from the conflict, where it became a symbol of Palestinian resistance and Israeli injustice. And those pictures pretty much determine the course of events for the next few years. Again, that cycle of violence, of Palestinian action, Israeli reaction, and very soon you don't know who did what first, who started, who responded, but things just continue. So from this point, I want us to go a little bit to the past and get a little bit of a historical background to the story that is unfolding. And I promise I'll try to do it as quickly as possible while still making sense. And in a sense, the way to approach it, I think, is acknowledging that there are two parallel narratives by the two national groups that emerge over the last century or so in the land that some call Palestine, others call Israel, and both sides agree is a holy land. So it's the story of two national groups in one very tiny holy land, which they need to learn how to share. And these are two pretty improbable national groups, starting, of course, with the story of the Jewish people, which is a narrative of people who go back to biblical times and claim to have given the world the gift of the Bible, to whom the land was promised by God, and who were able, after long tribulation, including 400 years of slavery in Egypt and 40 years of Exodus, to conquer the land, to make it their kingdom, to build the temple then destroyed twice. Both times there is an exile. The first one is fairly short. The second, much longer, about 1,800 years, and time of great persecution, time when the Jews, living both under the cross of Christianity and the crescent of Islam, suffer a large number of events in which they are forced into exile, forced into conversion, or outright being killed. all of course culminating in the most horrific event of the Holocaust during World War II at the hands of the Nazis. So the Jewish narrative is that story of suffering which miraculously, if you like, results in the nation of Israel coming back together under the notion of the ideology of Zionism, and they managed to get international support for their efforts, first by the British, later on by other nations as well, including ours, and they fight and they achieve their independence. So that's the Israeli-Jewish narrative of the conflict, but that is still pretty much the meta-narrative of the Israelis. On the other hand, we have the Palestinians, and from their perspective, they are the native population of Palestine, and they are the victims of a Western-oriented crusade, similar to the crusade of centuries earlier, imperialism that inflicts all of the Middle East, but in particular this little part of the world. The people who call themselves Israelis or Jewish people are people who are part of those invaders. They have no reason to be there. They simply took over by brute force and forced the Palestinians out. And therefore, justice can only prevail if and when the rights of the Palestinians are to be acknowledged. And of course, the question is, how do you reconcile both of these conflicting narratives, especially as both sides tend to be very good at remembering what the other side did to them. They are not so good at remembering what they did to the others, but they have very sharp memory of what was done to them. In a sense, victimhood and call for justice that sort of set one against the other. In essence, I would suggest here that only if and when some common narrative, some common thread, some ability to put together these two conflicting narratives into one that would be acceptable to both sides, only then would we start seeing a real reconciliation. And for the moment, we are very far from such a thing to happen. But of course, in history, there is not just this original narrative. There is also the occurrences of history. And in particular, there are a few phases that we need to point to. We have the beginning of Zionism. In the previous slide, we saw Theodor Herzl, the founder of the Zionist movement. We have another formative moment coming two decades later. If the Zionist movement was founded in 1897, in 1917 we have the Balfour Declaration, which is the statement of policy of the British government at the moment when the British army is on the verge of physically occupying from the Ottoman Turks the land of Palestine, which is to become the national homeland of the Jewish people. And we have the British Mandate that comes after for about 30 years, during which time the great success of the Zionist movement and the Jewish community in Palestine to transform itself into what I would call a state in the making, creating institutions, including effective force of self-defense, but also other institutions that would provide the ability to take over when the time comes to achieve their independence. The Palestinian Arab community tries to do the same thing, but to a far less success. And most of its achievement is in putting violent resistance to the Zionist Jewish growth in a variety of instances, but on the whole, it's a story of failure. And therefore, when we get to the first main juncture, the first big crossroad of 1948, when the international community, now the newly formed United Nations, decides on the partition of Palestine into two states, in the conflict that ensues, one side, the Israelis are successful in creating their state, the State of Israel, and in defending it against invasion by a number of Arab armies. The other side, the Palestinians, are defeated. Many of them, more than half of the population there, find themselves as refugees outside the boundaries of Palestine, or even within historical Palestine, but away from their original homes. And thus, the saga of the Palestinian refugees is starting, a saga that is still with us today, now in its third, fourth generation, when from an original number of about 750,000, we're talking about a population of roughly 5 million all over the Middle East and beyond. And that legacy of the Palestinian refugees is still very much with us from 1948, from 66 years ago. The other main crossroad occurs almost 20 years later. In 1967, what some people would call the Six-Day War, the biggest challenge by the neighboring Arab countries to try to defeat the Jewish state, to try to redress the defeat of 20 years earlier, which ends up quite improbably in an Israeli victory over a coalition of Arab countries and in effectively tripling the size of the State of Israel. The map of Israel from before and after, with all these new territories that were added, some of them temporarily and eventually returned, like Sinai, others like the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the Golan Heights, taken from Syria, still under Israeli control. And in a sense, what happens in 67 is regarded at the time as a miracle, but some observer already then start speaking about the curse of the blessing. The blessing being the victory that was unexpected and, of course, the greatest sense of security. But with it comes a population of Palestinians that are living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, many of them refugees from 48, and they need to find some answer, some solution to their problem. In a sense, the way I like to think of it, we are still today, 47 years later, we are still on the seventh day of the Six-Day War. We are still trying to figure out how to move from beyond the Six-Day War into something that would bring about peace. And that's pretty much where we've been for nearly five decades now. And of course, many things have happened since then. Perhaps the most important thing for the understanding of the conflict is what you might call the rebirth of the Palestinian identity, which unfortunately is related very much to violence from the beginning. The term used at the time in the late 60s by those militant Palestinian organizations from which Yasser Arafat that I mentioned earlier emerged, their term is armed resistance. And their notion is that only by armed resistance and only by armed struggle that would destroy Israel, only then can there be justice for the Palestinians. And for about 20 years, from 1967 or so until the late 1980s, this is the Palestinian narrative, that there is no room for two states, for Israel and Palestine. Only one needs to prevail over the other. And of course, at the same time, the Israelis, in a sense, live in a state of denial about the Palestinians. In the early 1970s, then Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir famously says, "There is no Palestinian people." I was, you know, when I came to mandatory Palestine and became a subject of the British mandate, I was a Palestinian. So neither side willing to acknowledge any of the rights of the other side. And in a sense, it continues to be a winner-take-all kind of situation, which also led to a number of confrontations from Black September of 1970, which is when the Jordanians destroyed the Palestinian presence, which is disruptive of their country, to the other Black September, the organization, the terrorist organization that is behind perhaps the most spectacular Palestinian terrorist attack in the Olympic Games of Munich in 1972. And then a few years later, the civil war in Lebanon, which is in many ways a cause of the involvement of the Palestinians in what is a Lebanese dispute, which led to eventually an Israeli invasion and occupation of Lebanon or parts of Lebanon, which extend the war outside of Palestine. And then, of course, towards the end of the 80s, we have the first intifada, the first uprising, Palestinian uprising, which also led to a new organization to emerge and to become prominent among the Palestinians, an organization that has been very much in the news this summer, Hamas, the Islamic resistance movement of the Palestinians, which challenges the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, and claim to be the only road for successful resistance against Israel. Of course, in many ways, we can look at Hamas as part of the bigger story in the Middle East, which is very much, of course, in the news today, as it has been in the last few years, that of Islamic radicalism, which, as you know, becomes perhaps the number one foreign policy issue right now on our agenda. Now, it is at that point in time, really, that we have the birth of the peace process, that we call the Oslo peace process, because the historical agreement was signed between Israel and the PLO. I should also say, I forgot to mention earlier, but I mentioned it at the beginning of my talk, that while Israel and the Palestinians resume much more direct conflict between them, at the same time, Israel is moving to become more at peace with some of its other neighbors, especially Egypt. It signs a peace treaty, historical peace treaty with Egypt in 1979, following that original Camp David conference. So now, 15 years later, and after more encounters and violence and the Palestinian uprising, the first one, we have the beginning of a peace process between Israel and the PLO, which in many ways it's a result of necessity. The PLO is at probably the lowest point in its history, especially after it has officially declared that it's no longer approaching the solution to the conflict as one to be achieved by violence, but rather through diplomacy. But when the opportunity seems to be coming for a new round in the Middle East, when Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait in what starts what we call the first Gulf War of 1991, Arafat unwittingly perhaps endorses Saddam Hussein, and when Saddam Hussein is defeated in Kuwait, Arafat is not in good shape. And his problem is that he might become irrelevant. On the other hand, from the Israeli side, the Gulf War ironically reflects how Israel is vulnerable to long-range attack. Israel is attacked by missiles from Iraq during the war, and they don't really have an answer for this. They also are at the verge of great expansion of their population with the end of the Cold War, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and the migration of about 1 million Russian Jews to Israel, which is both an opportunity but also a cause for some problems, especially having to find economic solutions. Plus, we have a more moderate Israeli government that is coming to power, that is willing to try the road to a different approach to peace. All of this leading to the historical Oslo Agreement, which is now 21 years old, signed in 1993, in which Israel and the PLO share or exchange recognition of each other. And for the first time, the Israelis recognize the PLO as a representative of a Palestinian nation. And even though they are not pledging yet, they're willing to recognize a Palestinian state, it is pretty much understood that that is the purpose at the end of the process. So we have a peace process that goes on throughout the 1990s, and it's a very flawed kind of process. Part of the problem is that there is no consensus among the Israelis or the Palestinians that this is the right way to go. And actually, those who oppose the process on both sides are fairly strong and fairly convincing in some ways, and those who are supporting it find it difficult to achieve a majority that would support it. And so the peace process goes back and forth with the blessing of the U.S. and the international community, but with only lukewarm support from both sides. It has a number of achievements. One of them is Israeli withdrawal from most of the urban areas, most of the heavily populated Palestinian areas, and the creation of a Palestinian Authority, which is understood to be a government in the making, and the road for Palestinian self-government. But the problem is that the peace process is derailed by extremists on both sides. Both the Hamas, which is retaliating against actions by Israeli right-wingers, particularly one in Hebron in 1994, and start a whole campaign of suicide bombing. From the Israeli side, in addition to what I mentioned about the activity of the Israeli settlers, and the settlements is a big problem since really the 1970s, but much more so the 1990s and beyond that. But also the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Rabin was assassinated in November of 1995, and in the minds of many Israelis with him, also peace was assassinated. And much of the hope for peace disappeared with him as well. And so the peace process continues in a way that really neither side is showing that much enthusiasm until it gets into that moment that I started with of Camp David, where for a moment the enthusiasm is back and people really expect something big to happen, and then it doesn't. Which leads us to the question of where we are now and where we are heading. And the last 14 years basically have seen all sorts of efforts to bring about a peace process, mostly coming from the part of the United States and to some extent the Europeans and the rest of the international community, and in some ways the Arab states as well. Essentially, when you look at the Bush administration that was in power for 8 years, we're talking about what was known as the roadmap to peace, but the roadmap essentially led to nowhere. There was never a full commitment, either by the Bush administration or, I would say, by the Obama administration, to really push both sides into the kind of decisions they would have to make. And so in many ways, you could say that certainly the last decade, since the end of most of the violence from the West Bank at least, this has been a wasted period, because neither side, and you might say that perhaps mostly the Israeli side, was not particularly eager to give up what they perceived to be important security concerns and gamble on peace. Of course, it didn't also help that the Palestinian side proved to be highly divided on this, especially between Hamas and the PLO. And this came really to a point of a crisis after the Israelis decided to do a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza in 2005. And they basically left Gaza and took all their settlers with them. The result a few months later was elections, ill-conceived elections to the Palestinian Authority, which resulted in the election of Hamas, which was quite a shocker for everyone, including Hamas itself. And basically since then, what we've seen is a stalemate where Hamas refuses to recognize officially Israel's right to exist. The Israelis, in return, with the help of the international community, isolate Hamas in Gaza and actually blockade Gaza. Hamas acquiring more and more weapons, trying to find a military answer to Israeli military superiority. And we've been having 3 or even 4 rounds of hostilities, the worst of them, of course, this summer, with the enormous destruction, especially in Gaza. And the only reason that we haven't had similar destruction in Israel is because Israel found a response to the Hamas rockets and managed to intercept them. But if such solution would not have been found, there is no question that Israeli casualties would have been probably as great as those of Hamas or those of the Palestinians. So essentially, this is where we are right now. And I'm afraid that if we go back to the title of this presentation, which is Making Sense of a Never-Ending Conflict, I'm not sure that I can actually deliver the goods and make sense of it. Because in many ways, I don't think anyone can make sense of it. Because on the face of it, it seems so obvious what the solution should be. It should be a two-state solution, living side by side, recognizing each other, and basically abandoning violence. But the problem is, how do you get there? And the biggest problem is the mistrust between the two parties and the fact that it's in many ways an asymmetrical kind of conflict. The truth of the matter is that one side, the Israeli side, has overwhelming advantage over the Palestinian side in terms of its both military power, obviously, but also its much stronger economy and its ability to create a very successful country against all odds, and a country that has a lot to gain by maintaining what it has achieved and very little desire to give up some of it, including, of course, very critical territories. And on the other hand, the Palestinians, the only thing that they really have to offer is to stop being stop trying to make Israeli life miserable, I would call it. They have the ability to make Israeli life miserable as well, but not much beyond that, quite frankly. And so it is an asymmetrical kind of conflict, which is driven mostly by mistrust and lack of goodwill on both sides. And how to try to regain that goodwill is a problem that no one, to my knowledge, has been able to find out. So this is where I'm going to stop my presentation, because I want to have a dialogue with you and address some of the questions that you have, and I'm sure that there are plenty.
Thank you. I thought that was a pretty balanced presentation, and I'm glad you talked about the asymmetrical aspect of this, because that seems to be the key, and which tells me that you can't really expect the two sides on their own to really come to much of an agreement when one side is 100 times literally more powerful than the other one. Therefore, it's going to require the intervention, if you will, of outside forces. I kind of compare this to two kids fighting on the playground. One guy is much bigger than the other one. Is the teacher just supposed to sit by, or is the administration of the school just supposed to sit by and do nothing? What is, in your mind, going to finally resolve this if the two parties indeed, being given this asymmetrical pattern, cannot really resolve it on their own? What do you foresee happening?
Well, obviously, if I had the formula to bring it to an end, I would probably be right now in Washington, D.C. in a think tank making a six-digit income in giving the right advice. I don't think anyone has been able to find the answer. As I suggested at the beginning, on its face, it's a very simple kind of answer. The only viable solution, at least at this stage of our shared existence as two nations, us being the Israelis and the Palestinians, the only viable solution is two states that would be able to live side by side but also separated from each other. Because if you look at the two big issues On the one hand, you have the issue of the occupation, which has now been 47 years, and occupation that has been, of course, very bad for the Palestinians, no doubt, but I would suggest equally bad for the Israelis. And the biggest problem that they have in achieving long-term stability and success. On the other hand, there is also terrorism and violence, and the notion that the Israelis have that their actual existence is at stake. So the only viable solution would be the creation of two states, two viable states, but with the stipulation that one of these states, the Palestinian states, should be demilitarized and should not have the option of threatening the Israeli state.
But won't that require international action, outside, if you will?
Absolutely, and not just action, but a lot of money coming basically from our pocket as taxpayers. Any solution would have to start with some sort of a Marshall Plan for the Palestinians. Because, you know, especially Gaza, the West Bank for some time has been doing a little bit better. Of course, everything is relative, and I'm talking here better than Gaza, not necessarily better than Israel. But it showed that some pragmatism can go a long way, pragmatism that we didn't haven't found in Gaza. Now, one thing that causes me to be a little bit optimistic, very little perhaps, earlier this summer, if I may digress for a second to a personal story, I led a group of community members and students from UNO to Israel, and one of the participants was my best friend, who happened to be Palestinian, from the West Bank originally, although he's been living in this country for many years. And through this friend, who is also good friends with the former Palestinian Prime Minister Salem Fayyad, we were able to meet Salem Fayyad, who was the Palestinian Prime Minister until last year, who is a very impressive person, let me tell you. And especially given the mediocrity of leadership on both sides in general, I think that he stands out as somebody who is pragmatic and who understands really that the only way to move forward is by building the Palestinian state from the bottom up. Talking less about resistance and glory and the things that really don't lead to anything positive, but trying to bring the build the foundations of a Palestinian state. This was a very impressive kind of meeting. Of course, the depressing thing is that he is no longer prime minister, and his ability to really be a major actor is limited. But I think that it's people like this that are really needed if we are going to have hope for the future. People who would look to the betterment of the life of their people. And it's especially critical among the Palestinians because in many ways, the way I look at Palestinian society, it's a traumatized society. No doubt brought about by the Israeli occupation, but also I think by some flaws in their own approach. And for me, the thing that is most telling is the glorification of suicide bombers. You know, the idea of a mother expressing happiness that her son or daughter gave their life for the cause. For me, this is something that is difficult to digest as somebody who's been a parent myself. And it's changing that psychology that is so important if there is hope for the future. Because the future is really the younger generation. And you are now talking about a second generation of Palestinians living under Israeli occupation and a second generation of Israelis living under Palestinian terrorism. I mentioned Munich earlier, and in many ways, you know, we think of 9/11. When 9/11 happened, Americans began to realize things that Israelis realized a generation earlier. You know, checkpoints at airports and always looking suspiciously at every abandoned baggage. Things like this, I grew up like this. So both people need that change. And that would not occur overnight. Frankly, I don't think it will occur during my lifetime. I hope that it will occur during the lifetime of some of those young folks in the background. And I would really like to hear more maybe from the students. If they have questions or things that they would like me to expand on.
Do you classify this more as a religious conflict or a territory conflict? Or can you really separate the two?
In many ways, it's not easy to separate. I would argue that it is first and foremost a national kind of conflict rather than a religious one. First of all, we need to recognize that Palestinians are not only Muslims but also Christians. And I'm fully aware of the fact that given broader trends in the region, some of which very dramatically recently, the life of Christians in the Middle East in general, and you might say in Palestine as well, have been much more challenging than they used to be for over 2,000 years. There used to be also Jews who defined themselves as Arab Jews. Nowadays, because of the conflict, you find less of this. Now, obviously, there is a religious element here. We are talking about the Holy Land, about Jerusalem, about a place that is, you know, the birthplace of Jesus for the Christians, the place of the two temples for the Jews, and the place where the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven, essentially the third holiest place in Islam. So you can't really separate the religious element from it. But I think that, you know, if you take, for example, Jerusalem, many people think that Jerusalem is the hardest topic really to overcome. And it's a very emotional topic. I mean, in a sense, the kiss of death for every Israeli politician is if he or she is accused of dividing Jerusalem. It's a little bit like raising taxes here, you know, as the big thing that would kill you politically. I believe it for a long time, that if other issues are resolved, if there is goodwill, and that's the key thing, goodwill and overcoming mistrust can be achieved, the Jerusalem question will resolve itself. And the religious conflict can be brought under control. Now, again, we need to think a little bit beyond just Israelis and Palestinians here, because there are things that happen around us. And one of the most problematic things to have happened in the Middle East in the last 40 years is the rise of radical Islam in its most militant, violent format. And it's very sad because historically, speaking now as a Jew, Jews used to fare much, much better under Islamic rule than under Christian rule for centuries. Islam, in its essence, is a tolerant religion that is willing to acknowledge that other people have the right to live safely under Islam. All this is gone now. You look at ISIS, you look at Al-Qaeda, there is no room for this, and sadly to say, Hamas as well. I mean, you look at Gaza, there are very, very few, if any, Christians in Gaza anymore. And the Christians in the West Bank, if you ask them, you know, at a moment of candor, they would say that's what they're much more afraid of Hamas controlling them than Israel. So radical Islam in its violence format is a problem for the entire region, and you might say beyond it, because it has international perspective as well. And it's only if that zealot approach, this exclusive approach, the approach that says there is no room for others who don't think like me, this has to be overcome. Now, in all fairness, and thank you for mentioning that I'm attempting to be balanced, the Jewish side has its own zealots as well, especially in the West Bank, some people that you might call messianic Zionists who believe that, you know, I mentioned earlier in 1967 that this is the time of the arrival of the Messiah is coming. You know that Jews believe that the Messiah has not come yet, even for the first time. So they are doing things that I very much am opposed to, and by the way, most Israelis are opposed to, but in some ways they have political clout in Israel today, which is far greater than their share of the population. So both sides have their problem with zealots. and they need to tame them and to allow people with goodwill to prevail. How to do it is tougher than saying that that's what should be done.
I have a couple questions. First of all, it seems that the surrounding Arab countries are always egging on the Palestinians to fight, all the way down to the last Palestinian, but they haven't really helped them in any way. Why?
Okay, you said you had two questions. You want me to answer this and then another.
And the second question is, why can't there be economic development? I mean, it seems that, at least to my view, the Palestinians are so focused on the cause and the fight, they have forgotten to take care of their people. Why aren't they doing anything to develop economically? They have the brains. There are people there that have the brains to do it.
Let me first of all, if I may, introduce my wife, who is asking the question, who is, by the way, a terrific artist. Well, let me answer both questions, starting with the other Arab countries. And essentially, I think that Palestinians themselves will pretty much agree with your assessment about Arab countries not really caring truly for the Palestinians. And part of the story really is Arab regimes, despotic regimes in countries like Syria, Egypt, Iraq, that for many years, many decades, used the pretext of the fight against Israel as a way to legitimize their control over their people. And in many ways, we were hoping a few years ago with what we call the Arab Spring that this would change the discourse. And it doesn't seem right now to have done that. Quite the opposite. Now our choices are between despotism and anarchy and complete lack of security for people. So I don't think that historically the Arab countries prove themselves as part of the solution, but rather as part of the problem. Now, with respect to the question of why don't the Palestinians develop economically more, as I indicated earlier, there are people, forward-thinking people like Salem Fayyad, who think exactly that, that this is the real indicator of success long-term. And we definitely need more people like this. We do need to acknowledge, though, in all fairness, that the Israeli policy of occupation and, frankly, exploitation of the Palestinian economy did not really help. The Israelis acted fairly selfishly in terms of appropriating most of the resources instead of sharing them, and it was, in their mind, in their interest, to keep the Palestinian economy in many ways subordinated to the Israeli economy. And the Israelis themselves need to change their way of thinking as well. But there's no doubt that the Palestinians need to take more agency over their lives with the blessing of the Israelis and the international community, which will have a role, and the Arab countries that need to change their attitude. There has to be a systemic solution. But there are certainly plenty of people to blame for the sorry situation of the Palestinians today.
I just want to know why Egypt is always playing the mediation role in the conflict. Why Egypt? Why not any other country than Egypt?
Well, in many ways, Egypt is really a very sad story. And it's a country that used to think of itself, and I think in many ways its people still try to think of themselves as the leaders of the Arab world. But in many ways, Egypt is more a symptom of the growing of the greater crisis within the Arab world than anything else. When you think about Egypt, you have to start with a very alarming kind of statistics that I think is determining what's happening there, and this is that Egypt doubles its population every generation, sometimes every decade. From a country of about 2 million at the at the beginning of, you know, at the 1800s, it now has nearly 90, perhaps over 90 million by now. It cannot sustain that population with its own resources. The solution found by all Egyptian rulers since at least the last 70 years, since the early 1950s, was suppression, suppressing the population. Military regime after military regime, crony capitalism or socialism, fake socialism, big expensive projects, and we now have a new one that the new ruler, he wants to have another lane to the Suez Canal, to build another Suez Canal parallel to the other one, which I think is pretty ridiculous, but pretty much in line with all these big projects that prove to be more a problem than a solution. And in the process, a lot of oppression and a lot of dashed hopes for equality or at least for a future for younger people. And in essence, the events in Egypt, the what we call the Tahrir Square movement of 2011, was an attempt to change that. And unfortunately, the way we see it today, 3 years later, almost 4 years by now, is really a failure. Instead of Mubarak, we got Sisi. We had a short phase of the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power more or less democratically, but effectively have the idea of one man, one vote, one time. And democracy ends with them, and they try to turn their version of oppressing others, and eventually failed. So I'm not sure that I have a positive prognosis for Egypt anytime soon. I do think that what we saw in 2011 was very genuine. I think that people in Egypt and frankly elsewhere in the Middle East, including the Palestinians, they do want to have better life. They do want dignity. They want to have ability to live and to inherit to their children a better world, just like we do. How they can achieve this, I don't know that anyone knows. I don't think the Egyptians have found any answer. I hope they will, for their sake, and I hope everybody else in the Middle East, including the Palestinians, will find it as well. I think the Israelis, to the large part, have found it. All they want is to be able to live in peace with what they achieved.
I want to thank everyone for your great attention this evening. And Dr. Gershovitz, it has been a pleasure. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you for being such a great audience.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a talk by Moshe Gershovitz, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and director of the Natan and Hannah Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at UNO. The topic of his presentation has been Israel and Palestine, Making Sense of a Never-Ending Conflict. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, September 24, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.